So with all that preliminary, I'd like to do formal introduction for Professor Shattuck. Welcome to the 425th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, both to our members and guests who are here today and to our public radio audience, reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting comes to you from Northport, Maine. I'm George Look, president of the forum. The forum was founded in 1983 as a citizens' forum for study and discussion of the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies. We are now in our 36th year of monthly meetings featuring prominent speakers covering all aspects of U.S. foreign policy. To listen to past forum presentations or to find out about upcoming forum programs, visit our website at midcoastforum.org. Today we are very pleased to have with us Professor John Shattuck, who will be speaking on Viktor Orban and Donald Trump, the rise of illiberal democracies in Europe and the U.S. John Shattuck is professor of practice at the Fletcher School of Tufts University. He is an international legal scholar, diplomat, human rights leader, and former university president. Early in his career, he held positions that include director of the ACLU Washington office, vice president for government, community, and public affairs at Harvard University, lecturer at the Harvard Law School, and senior associate in the program on science, technology, and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Mr. Shattuck was Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor from 1993 to 1997, and served as a U.S. Ambassador to the Czech Republic from 1998 to 2000. He then returned to the U.S. as the Chief Executive Officer of the John F. Kennedy Library Foundation, where he served until 2009. From 2009 to 2016, he was president and rector of Central European University, an international graduate institution in Budapest, Hungary. The Shattuck Center on Conflict, Negotiation, and Recovery was named in his honor when he left the university. Professor Shattuck received a law degree from the Yale Law School in 1970. John, a warm welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Thank you, George. Thank you very much, George. Very wonderful introduction, and it's a delight to be here on this gorgeous day. I'm surprised to see so many people actually inside and enjoying your lunch and hopefully your speaker rather than out there where everything is so glorious. I was saying to friends last night that I don't know how it is that you can ever pull yourself away from Camden or places up here and on the mid-coast, but I assume that the weather isn't always quite as nice as it is today. I live part-time, at least, on a small farm in Vermont, and so we share weather. I think we probably have the same concerns about what happens. I was told that if I could make recommendations for speakers for your February forum, I might get a special bonus, particularly if I was able to persuade them to come. On the other hand, I know the quality of both the speakers I can hear and the attraction of, above all, of coming to the forum is very high, so I'm sure you won't have difficulties. I appreciate, George Look, your warm welcome and introduction. I also want to thank Jan Rosenbaum, who's been very helpful here. And thank you, Jan, for all you're doing for us, for Ellen, and for me, as well as obviously for the forum. And I want to particularly greet my old friend Ann Beaudry and her husband Craig, her new husband Craig, and congratulate them on that wonderful occasion. And there are many friends in this room, and I won't name the others, but it's great to be among friends at this time, and we need friends at this time, and in a sense, that's what I'm going to be talking about. We're living in very perilous times, very interesting times as well. I think you can tell from the title of my talk that I want to explore with you the great democracy drama that's unfolding in Europe and the United States. starring a pair of villains right out of central casting. Viktor Orban is the Prime Minister of Hungary. You may be familiar with him. The other person you're quite familiar with, Donald Trump. I thought it would be interesting to describe this transatlantic drama from my perspective of about 30 years of commuting back and forth between Europe and the United States in my work and seeing this drama unfold. But let's start with the story, and let's be very upbeat as we first consider what the situation is as it is unfolding in this transatlantic drama about democracy. The story is about the great hopes for democracy that were unleashed at the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall. In the summer of 1988, before these events, I was sent by Amnesty International to Czechoslovakia, which was then still very much in the hands of a Stalinist regime. And my assignment was to meet with Rita Klimova, who is a leading Czech dissident, who would report to me on how another and perhaps much more famous dissident, Václav Havel, was doing in prison. We met in a crowded outdoor Prague cafe in order to avoid being bugged by the regime, and she told me she expected that Havel would in fact be released soon, which he was, but that the communist regime would remain in power for quite a long time. But then suddenly and miraculously, as we all know, a year later, the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, the Velvet Revolution, wonderfully named because of its peaceful protest nature, swept through Czechoslovakia. It was a euphoric time. It was a time symbolized by the day that I opened the New York Times and found a photo of Rita, the woman that I'd met with in this Prague cafe, and a front page story about how she had just been named the first Czech ambassador of democratic Czechoslovakia by the new president of then Czechoslovakia, Václav Havel. A rather remarkable set of events occurring within only 1 year. The pace of change was dizzying. I think we all remember it. Democracy seemed triumphant. The Soviet Union fell. Dictatorships in Latin America collapsed. Apartheid ended in South Africa, and Nelson Mandela was elected president. Except in China, where the Tiananmen democracy movement was crushed, the political world was being transformed, or so it seemed. But I think now, looking back, over the last three decades, we can see that two powerful conflicting forces were generated by the end of the Cold War, and these forces have defined our world ever since. First, very optimistically, were the forces of integration, the collapse of barriers, starting with the Iron Curtain and the political and economic barriers separating Eastern and Western Europe for many, many decades. Then the spread of democracy and the market economy, then the expansion of the European Union and NATO, so that today we have 28 countries in the European Union, and finally the rise of economic and cultural globalization, which was a word that we kind of marveled at the time, thinking that there was a kind of magic to the prospect of transnational, international capital crossing borders. These were the integrating forces of the post-Cold War world, forces that caused commentators like Francis Fukuyama, in a burst of optimism very typical of the time, to predict in 1990, and I quote, "the end of history and the rise of liberal democracy as the final form of government." Fukuyama has explained that he didn't mean that that was truly going to be the end of history since. But I think events have proved him true in the sense that it wasn't the end of history. So he's appropriately taking some of this back. But he's a very thoughtful commentator. I don't want to put him down. But the fall of the Berlin Wall also unleashed a whole different set of forces, the forces of disintegration. And they have, in some ways, been the dominant forces of this period. First, with the early warnings about the downside of globalization, the movement of industries overseas and the loss of jobs and workers' incomes. Then came the collapse of Yugoslavia and the mass atrocities and genocide in Bosnia and Kosovo. And after that, these are all very familiar events for us, 9/11, the major terrorist attacks in Europe and the US, then the disastrous war in Iraq, the financial crises, the bank bailouts, the growing economic inequality, the mass migration of refugees from the wars in the Middle East and the failed states in North Africa and Central America. All of this has happened within these 30 years, along with many other events that are similar. Finally, the rise of nationalist movements across Europe and the US, signaling the outbreak of transatlantic populist rebellion against the political and economic elites who had been promoting the forces of integration after the fall of the Berlin Wall. So what happened when these two powerful forces collided, which inevitably they did, frequently? This is when the democracy drama began. And for 7 years, Ellen and I were in the middle of it in Hungary, where I was serving as president of Central European University. I saw firsthand how an ambitious political climber like Viktor Orban, who had previously been himself a dissident who brought about in some ways the changes in Hungary that occurred in 1989, was able to manipulate the populist rebellion and the fears that I now want to describe in some detail in order to take over a new European democracy and turn it into a semi, and some would say, full authoritarian state in Europe, in the European Union, in 2019. So at the end of my term as president in 2016, Ellen and I came back to the US just in time for the election of our other hero of this story, Donald Trump. Our friends joked that perhaps we were carrying Orban's anti-democracy disease with us. But of course, sadly, as we know, the disease was already spreading and the democracy and democracy across Europe and the US was already deeply infected. So what was this mysterious disease? What are we really talking about here? What happened? I think the answer to that question, you need to take a close look at the basic elements of liberal democracy that have come under attack from Orban and Trump and other far-right nationalists whom we know also very well beyond Europe, like Erdogan and Putin and others. Free and fair elections, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, an independent judiciary, the rule of law, minority rights, civil liberties, checks and balances against concentrations of power, public goods like health, education, and welfare. These are democracy's safeguards against tyranny. And without them, there can be no democracy. And in fact, an illiberal democracy, the title of my talk, comes from Orban. It's an oxymoron. It's a charade invented by what I would call takeover tyrants like Orban and Trump. But there's a flaw in this analysis, so I don't want to go too far with it at the moment without stepping back and looking how it was that this crisis emerged in further detail. Because today, on both sides of the Atlantic, there's a real problem with democracy. Many people don't think it's working for them. Democratic discontent has been growing for years. Already by 2014, 5 years ago, a European Commission poll revealed that 68% of Europeans distrusted their elected leaders and governments, way up from only 25% in 2002, 12 years earlier. A Gallup poll in the same year showed almost identical results in the United States. 65% of Americans were dissatisfied, up from only 21% in 2002. So these negative polling trends on both sides of the Atlantic were early warnings about the growing popular anger at political and economic elites and the democratic institutions that they controlled. In Europe, after 1989, an elite consensus formed around three central ideas: European Union integration, the forces of integration, bringing Europe closer together; market economics, free and independent market economy. We'll get to that in a minute. And multi-ethnic society, all seemingly very strong and powerful elements of the forces of integration. This consensus created the elite consensus created the image of Europe as a technocratic, corporate, and cosmopolitan part of the world. But most ordinary Europeans didn't relate to this image. They were buffeted by the forces of disintegration, especially the financial crisis, which created hard times, particularly in places like Hungary, and the immigration crisis, which produced cultural anxiety, about which I want to speak just a little bit more in a moment. And of course, the same things were happening at the same time in the US. Now, this led to two forms of populist rebellion. There was economic rebellion by people left behind by the loss of jobs, stagnating incomes, austerity programs, and cuts in social welfare, which were the byproducts of globalization, the economic globalization, from which the elites were seen to be benefiting. Then there was cultural rebellion by people who felt threatened by minorities, outsiders, and refugees whom the elites were seen to be promoting with their liberal policies. These rebellions were not just out there as kind of brief flashes, but in fact, they had deep roots in the reaction to the major social and economic revolutions of our time. The three revolutions are, first, the market revolution, starting with Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, which had promised to stimulate economic growth by deregulating the economy drastically and by drastically cutting government spending on all but basic elements of security, cutting the social safety net, which in fact produced unprecedented and has produced unprecedented levels of economic inequality. The second revolution, one that many in this room, certainly I myself, have been deeply involved in, was the Civil Rights Revolution, which strengthened democracy immeasurably by broadening the participation of previously excluded minorities and women, but which today has sparked a counter-revolution by the dominant white, mostly male, former political majorities. The third revolution was the digital revolution, in which we're all immersed, which has created a vast increase in communication, but has also led to the rise of social media echo chambers and the spread of disinformation. Now, the populist reaction to these three revolutions fundamentally altered the playing field of democracy. Market deregulation led to the loss of shared benefits of economic growth and huge inequality between the top 10% and everyone else. The backlash against the civil rights movement led to the toxic politics of racism, sexism, and bigotry, and the explosive growth of social media led to the loss of common narratives based on facts and truth and the spreading of lies and propaganda. These reactions produced a climate of fear, which is really the climate in which we're living today, among the people who felt left behind in particular, and their greatest fear was the fear of demographic change, change that would put them in positions in which they didn't feel that they had any further control over their lives. Some whites, especially white men, were threatened by the racial, sexual, and cultural diversity they believed was being imposed on them by distant elites. The old white male political majority was being displaced by newly empowered women and minorities who themselves had long been left behind and discriminated against and were now finally receiving recognition. And all of this was happening as the US was becoming almost inexorably a majority-minority country. And the rising political strength of people of color was viewed as a threat to the mostly white Republican Party, which began to work to suppress their votes, while the racism of right-wing political leaders began to poison the political atmosphere. And the impact of all of these demographic fears and changes is summed up on democracy succinctly by my Harvard colleague, Danielle Allen, who says, I think very, and it's worth quoting very pithily, the world has never before built a multi-ethnic democracy in which no one ethnic group is in the majority. So what happens to democracy in this climate of fear? And I think for an extreme example, and this is why I've chosen to take you to Europe, let's look at Hungary, which is Europe's laboratory for nationalism and populism. The financial crisis hit the Hungarians harder than most other Europeans. Many people began to feel that they were no better off than they had been under communism. Hungarians have a long-standing fear of being victims, the product of centuries of outside invasions by Mongols and Turks and Russians and Austrians and Germans and Soviets. So they've always felt that the world is coming at them. They had little experience with democracy before 1989, and their civil society was weak and stunted by the long history of outside domination. So this set the stage for a nationalist politician to take over, and in walked Viktor Orban, who fanned the flames of populism by stimulating the Hungarians' victim mentality. He attacked the European Union, which he called the New Moscow. He mobilized Hungarians against Middle East refugees by calling them a threat to Christian civilization. He campaigned on what is now a very familiar slogan, but this is a long time ago, "Make Hungary Great Again." And he promised Hungarians that he would rescue them from Brussels and bankers and socialist holdovers from the old regime. Above all, he boasted that he was building a new form of government, which he called illiberal democracy. Let's get rid of all of those checks and balances and elements that stand in the way of real democracy, he said. But this is really an Orwellian term invented to justify using a democratic election to attack the very democratic institutions that stand in the way of authoritarianism. So after he was elected in 2010, he set out to rewrite the Hungarian constitution and eliminate its system of checks and balances. He subverted an independent judiciary by packing the courts, limiting their jurisdiction, and forcing judges to retire. We can see that as a real danger potentially here. He took over an independent media by using political and financial pressure, targeted regulation and disinformation, and starting his own various kinds of media outlets that would support the regime. He attacked civil society by accusing NGOs of being foreign agents and hitting them with heavy fines and taxes and restrictions. And he controlled Hungarian universities, like the one I was running by, although I wasn't running a Hungarian university, it was an international university. But the Hungarian universities, he cut their funding and censored their curricula. And in our case, he used regulatory repression to make it impossible for the university to issue internationally accredited degrees in Hungary because he didn't want any international influence in Hungary. Orban's political staying power, he's now been in office for more than 9 years, has made him the strongman of the far right on both sides of the Atlantic. Steve Bannon calls him Trump before there was Trump, I think quite appropriately. So how does this compare with what's going on in the rest of Europe and then in the United States? The same fears and anxieties and anger at distant elites are still driving very much populist nationalist movements like Brexit in the UK, the Northern League in Italy, and the Front National in France. Brexit, as we know, has produced virtual political chaos, actual political chaos. The Italians are now trying to create a pan-European far-right alliance, which would bring together all of the Viktor Orbans of Europe. There aren't too many, but they're growing in number. And Marine Le Pen's Front National recently outpolled French President Emmanuel Macron in the European parliamentary elections. But before we go too far in thinking Europe has fallen prey entirely to this, let's look a little more closely. The future of these European right-wing movements, I think, is very unclear. They had only mixed success in the parliamentary elections across Europe in May. They won 29% of the seats in the European Parliament, but they lost support in Germany, where the Green Party has surged, in Spain, where the socialists have gained and are in full power, in the Netherlands, where the pro-EU governing party beat back a populist challenge, and in other EU countries like Austria and Slovakia, where the far right has done far less well and has been pushed back. It's still, elements of it are there. In fact, I think a pro-EU political center may now be emerging across Europe in reaction to the chaos of Brexit as pro-EU parties learn to respond to populist anger by reforming the EU while defending democracy. But I think two large questions loom over the future of democracy and these parties in both Europe and the United States. The first big question, and this is particularly salient here today, is about immigration. How will progressive pro-democracy parties respond to the disastrous and violently inhumane anti-immigrant actions of Orbán, Trump, and all the other far-right politicians? So far, they've responded with outrage, but they have not responded with any answers to the issues and questions that are raised by immigration. They have not come up with an answer, either in Europe or in the United States, the Democrats. And I think until a comprehensive immigration policy that respects human rights while controlling borders and showing a pathway to citizenship for those who are in the borders, these parties, particularly the Democratic Party here in the U.S., won't reach moderate voters who are confused and receptive to xenophobic anti-immigration politics. The second big question, which I think hangs over the future of these pro-democracy parties, including our own, is how they will respond to the technological revolution in the workplace that's creating huge uncertainty about the future of work and employment. Here again, until this question is answered with realistic and progressive policies that can be articulated on employment and education and training, and perhaps on social safety nets that protect those who are laid off, that are stronger than we now have, the appeal of populism against the technological revolution will remain strong. So what about the two villains of the anti-democracy drama, Viktor Orban and Donald Trump? They're both going strong, continuing in power. They have both a lot, and they have a lot in common. And in fact, if you look closely at the three models of the Trump presidency, they all come right out of the Orban playbook. Doesn't mean that they were designed by Orban, but they are certainly similar to what I just told you about has happened in Hungary. First is the authoritarian model. As we know, Trump built his base and his brand by assaulting pluralist institutions like the media, which he calls the enemy of the people, and by lying and using disinformation against what he calls fake news, the principal tools of authoritarian government. The second, which is in a sense contrary to the first model, is the anti-government model, which in some ways is a long-standing Republican tradition since the Reagan administration in the U.S. But Trump has taken this to a new extreme, which is by tearing down the administrative state through deregulation, especially in economic and environmental policies, and dismantling or severely injuring the professional civil service. Many of you come from that field, as I do as well. Third, in a way, is the most familiar model that we have of the Trump presidency, which is the polarization model, used very effectively by Orban, which appeals to populist fear by stimulating racism, smearing opponents, and destroying the norms of democratic governance. Trump is very good at all these things, I think we know. So let me say a few words in conclusion, a few words in conclusion by asking us, and I hope to get some answers out of you as well in the question period, how resilient is democracy in the U.S. in the face of this rising tide of populism, the anger justified in many ways at the elites that have controlled or seem to be controlling democratic institutions in the U.S. I think last fall's midterm election showed that the electoral aspects of American democracy seem to be resilient. The elections produced the highest voter turnout in a non-presidential year by minorities and younger voters, despite the ongoing campaign of voter suppression and gerrymandering by Republicans. I've written a report about this called The War on Voting Rights that was published this spring by Harvard, and I'm now working on a new project, Renewing Human Rights and Responsibilities, which looks further at the resilience of the American electoral process. But I think we need to face up to the fact that there is a big difference between the democracy crisis in Europe, with all the difficulties that it's facing, but nonetheless some growing pro-EU sentiment in Europe, where there's only three countries in which the far right is in power, and the US, where the far right is in full control of the White House and the Senate and has taken over the Republican Party. This is the headline. We know this. The Republican Party is both scared of Trump and mesmerized by him. And it has been turned into Trump's shill and his battering ram in Congress. It is not a governing party in any traditional sense of the word. The Republicans have given up any credible claim to be a conservative party by yielding to Trump's anti-democracy agenda and doing nothing, except in a few small instances, to try to stand up to things that have happened. In the words of the Yale political scientist Jacob Hacker, writing in this month's Foreign Affairs, the Republicans have become, and I quote, an anti-system party that seeks to foment tribalism, distort elections, and subvert democratic institutions and norms. So we're in a very dangerous period right now. The Mueller investigation is over. It's up to the Congress to decide what to do about Trump's criminal abuses of power. The president is stonewalling efforts by House Democrats to subpoena Mueller's evidence of obstruction of justice. Of course, one way for them to fight back is to start an impeachment inquiry, but if the House votes to impeach, I think we know the Republican Senate, certainly the Senate that's controlled by the current Republican Party, will block it. And in this toxic political climate, polarization is worse than ever, and as the presidential race heats up, Trump is intensifying his attacks on the media, on the electoral process, and on all the guardrails of democracy. Now, let's step back. Let's give ourselves a breather from this bad news that I've been, and try to think about how to turn it around. How do we respond to all this? In a moment, I'd like to hear your thoughts. I think the big question, and it's a real question, is whether the very dangers that democracy faces today might actually stimulate its revival. Might not be the case in a time where we take things for granted more than we do today, where we can't take anything for granted. But in order for democracy to be revived as a result of these dangers, five things will have to happen, in my estimation. First, we have to recognize that the populist nationalist rebellion is an authentic reaction to the excesses of globalization and inequality that are destroying communities and leaving people behind in dying cities and towns across America and in Europe. There are populist movements on the left, as we know, as well as the right, and they may prove to be the shock troops of reform, calling for fundamental changes in our democratic institutions as a way of saving democracy. We need to listen to them. We should not constantly try to push them away or to say we are only going to listen to moderation. We need to understand their demand for recognition and their demand for political response. The second thing that has to happen is we need to build coalitions across political divides, putting aside differences in order to connect on, I think, the very broad demand for economic fairness and opportunity that has really been pushing forward more and more since the changes that were brought about by the end of the Cold War. This kind of inclusive populism, that is to say, populism which includes all kinds of people and backgrounds and diversities, as opposed to Trump's racist exclusionary brand, can break down the polarization on which he thrives. We should take inspiration from earlier forms of inclusive populism that brought together urban workers. This is the American farmer labor movement of the 19th century that brought together urban workers, white farmers, and black sharecroppers, and ultimately led to the progressive movement of the early 20th century. There's a great potential today, I believe, for a similar left-right coalition on economic fairness and inequality, and I think several of the Democratic presidential candidates are trying to build one. Third, and most practically, we need to vote and encourage others to vote. Participating in Get Out the Vote campaigns, in registration campaigns, in the 10 swing states, mostly in the Midwest, where the presidential election will be decided, is probably the single most important and maybe even the only important thing at this particular moment that we can do to save democracy beyond casting our own vote. So this is critical. Politicians who attack democracy must be punished at the polls. And I think we can take heart from the fact that 40 incumbents were defeated in the midterm elections precisely because they were supporting Trump's anti-democracy agenda. The fourth thing we need to do is to restore the idea that democracy is about negotiation. It's negotiation, agreeing between those who disagree. Very difficult to do, to be sure, but we've almost completely lost it in the climate of polarization that we have today. Without negotiation, there is only polarization, gridlock, and conflict, which is why so many people are angry at Washington. I go back to the days, as many of you here do, where there was much more bipartisan cooperation in the Congress. Two of my heroes, one who was a friend, it was Ted Kennedy, and on the other side was John McCain. Where are these giants, and where is the spirit that brought them together? We need to reinvent it, and I don't think it's impossible, because I think people are demanding it. The polls are telling us that most Americans want to end polarization, and it's certainly what democracy most needs. Fifth and finally, and above all, we need to recognize that saving democracy is a patriotic struggle for survival, not just a liberal political cause. For too long, liberals, like myself and others, have surrendered the symbols of patriotism to the right. We need to reclaim the flag and the Constitution in order to push back the appeal of right-wing nationalism. Patriotism is different from nationalism. It's about defending democracy, not destroying it. That was the rallying cry of the patriots who started the American Revolution, and it should be the rallying cry of all patriots today. So let me close with just a few words about history, and then I want your comments and questions. When the Constitution was drafted, James Madison described the state of political dysfunction at that time, the late 18th century, in words that could well have been written today. He said, "Complaints are everywhere heard that our government is unstable and oppressive, that the public good is disregarded in the conflict of rival parties, and that measures are too often decided by the superior force of interested and overbearing political powers." Now, to get out of that crisis, those who wrote the Constitution had to figure out how factions could be harnessed by creating a system of checks and balances, how democratic norms could be developed for conflict management and compromise. And when these restraints were destroyed by the oppressive weight of slavery, the Civil War, the Jim Crow era, and the Gilded Age, they had to be rebuilt, stimulated by the Great Depression, two world wars, and the Civil Rights Movement. And when they were overridden by presidents who abused their power, they had to be restored by public outcry and pressure, for example, by calling for the impeachment of Richard Nixon. So let me close with two quotes that point the way to what we can do as citizens. The late Speaker of the House, whom I also knew, Tip O'Neill, many of you as well, may have famously declared, you know, that all politics are local. But this is a very good piece of advice. Democracy begins at home. We should be activists in our own communities. Clearly you are. This is what your community is. I can sense the the activism which you bring to this talk. As the 19th century European observer of American democracy, Alexis de Tocqueville once remarked, "The greatness of America lies not in being more enlightened than other nations, but in her ability to repair her faults." So today we should begin to repair our faults by starting a new pro-democracy rebellion and getting people to vote so that we can bring about the revolutionary changes that we need to save our democracy. Now, I'd welcome your questions and comments about anything I've said and your own thoughts, above all, about the future of democracy in the U.S. and Europe. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John, for a very thought-provoking discussion. We're going to collect questions from our audience here, and I will take the prerogative of the moderator to ask the first question. And it seems to me that the world is so internationally connected at this point that globalization has already occurred. Can these nationalist movements really reverse that trend, or we have a clash now? How's it going to sort out?
There's no way. Nor can many of the things that have been set in motion since the end of the Cold War that I called the forces of disintegration be changed, but particularly the globalization. But globalization creates a political imperative, not just a moral imperative, but a political imperative to respond to the populace who say, we're left behind, we're not getting anything, our own welfare is deeply affected by what's happened, the closing down of this industry or that, and the changes that are occurring as a result of this vast global engine of economic development and growth, which itself is not a bad thing, but it is only a good thing if indeed it is used as an engine for creating opportunity for those who have been left behind by it, which is a political challenge.
Yes, I know. I can hope that can happen. It's an interesting question. I feel that poor quality of educational system in many areas of the country plays an important role in fostering populism, racism, acceptance of fake news, etc. What do you see as the role of education in supporting the strengthening of liberal democracies?
Critical, obviously critical. I think one of the things that's most disappointing about much education today at the grade school level is the lack of what we used to call civic education. I can see enough people in the audience who are my age who will remember. We used to take civics classes. We used to be taught what these various elements of our government were all about and why they were important. That's gone. The STEM understandable reasons why we go for science and technology and math, very importantly, but have crowded all of this out. Now, that's a narrow question, but it's a very important question. But civics is not just about something that you learn in the classroom and grade school. It's also something that needs to be practiced in the community. I think that the quality of education remains high in many communities, but the quality of understanding of what it means to be a citizen and the responsibilities that you have as a citizen, as well as the rights that you have, are really given over, I think, often to Fox News and other kind of propaganda channels, which will tell us about that. But indeed, there are ways of, I think, understanding the educational the objectivity and quality of education in a much more effective way than by getting it through media.
And then there's a follow-up question kind of here that also relates to education. Do you think the educated youth, say the Yale students or the ones at Tufts, would agree with your particularly pessimistic view of the U.S.?
Well, I hope you tuned into the final remarks that I made. I'm not necessarily a pessimist about the U.S. And as far as the students are concerned, let me say something about that, but save that for a moment. And no, I remain optimistic that we have an engine of action and activity, particularly in the civil society elements that we have, but we also saw it in the voting in 2018. that can achieve significant change, and we have it within us to do that. Unfortunately, in countries like Hungary and other countries in Eastern Europe, where civil society has been so repressed for so long, even today as a result of the 40 years of the Cold War, we don't see the same thing. Now, having said that, I will say that Ellen and I have just spent an interesting month in Bruges, Belgium, at the College of Europe, where I was a Fulbright professor. And I have students in Europe as well as students in the U.S. And I do find that the European students, by and large today, mine anyway, are more optimistic than the American students. For one reason, they can envision a Europe that is that something that they really want to fight for, that will continue to be open and they can travel and cross borders and have the various opportunities. Now, these are, of course, European students who themselves are going to be quite successful. The American students that I have at Tufts and at Harvard, I think are still confused and befuddled about what it is we're trying to do as a nation today. What are we trying to accomplish? And obviously the pollution of the whole political discourse that has occurred, not just in Trump, but as a result of many of the technological changes that I've talked about in social media, et cetera, I think has created that. So, you know, I'm not pessimistic, ultimately, but I do find that my American students are a bit less optimistic than my European students.
Here's one about not just the U.S. democracy, but throughout the world. Assuming the U.S. revives its own democracy, how concerned should we be about other democracies falling to the right, far-right regimes, especially non-Western democracies like India, perhaps the largest democracy in the world?
Well, this phenomenon of populism and popular anger at elites is a global phenomenon. And it is something that we should both be concerned about, but we should understand. It's not simply something that we can go out and inveigh against as part of U.S. foreign policy. It's something that we need to understand is very unique in each country. Now, you know, our primary challenge right now, I think, is to restore the democratic health of our own country, and I think we can do that. I think one of the reasons that this sort of right-wing, illiberal movement that I've talked about is sweeping the globe is the lesson that's being sent from Washington that this is all possible. This is what you can do. This is probably the most dangerous aspect of the Trump regime. That no longer is there seen to be a kind of central, whatever you else might think about the United States, one might think about it, a country which is dedicated to the continuation of liberal democracy and the institutions of that. When those are attacked as viciously as they have been, the signal is sent to the Uzbekistans and the Indias and the any number of other leaders. In fact, I think to some extent, Viktor Orban in Hungary has been revitalized by the election of Donald Trump. I was able to maintain the integrity of our university during the 7 years that I was there, but once Trump was elected, Orban really took the gloves off, and then he went after Central European University, and that was all because of, largely because of the strength that he felt coming from Trump.
Thank you. Few here, a couple on immigration. So people wanting to know, is there a country that you consider a model for immigration policy, or can you suggest some direction for a responsible immigration policy?
Well, I think actually the United States has been a model at various times for immigration, and I think when the immigration laws were reformed by Ted Kennedy and Al Simpson, by the way, that was a wonderful example of a bipartisan effort. Senator Al Simpson is still very much with us from Wyoming, a conservative Republican senator, and Ted Kennedy, of course. In 1970, can't remember the exact date, but the most recent revision of the immigration laws, I think, was very humane. It controlled the borders, it limited access, provided a pathway to citizenship for those who were in the country, allowed guest workers and various other elements to come in. So we're not a country that has no experience with a relatively enlightened immigration policy. In fact, quite the contrary, we do. Europe, I think, is struggling for different reasons with immigration because it's the European Union and yet it's 28 countries and they can't really come to an agreement about how to control the borders. They need to, absolutely. So I wouldn't look to Europe and Europe is the other magnet for immigration apart from the United States. So I look back to ourselves. I think we can do this. We have the capacity. Legislation has been introduced even today, which would provide appropriate control methods, border control, security, as well as pathways to citizenship. So I'm not pessimistic about that. The politics, of course, are not playing well. And frankly, the Democrats have yet to make it clear, the Democratic candidates, make it clear what their positions are on immigration, other than their hand-wringing, rightly so, about what Trump is doing at the borders.
You cited some general trends that led to the rise of populism and nationalism. And here's a question. Can you cite particular errors or misjudgments in EU or U.S. leadership that contributed significantly to this problem? I mean, are there really key turning points there somewhere?
Yeah. I can't think of any sort of single key turning point. I think the history of populism in our country recently began with the Tea Party movement, which of course was the anti-Obama populism that came about in 2010, 11, 12. I don't want to blame Obama for stimulating the Tea Party. Quite the opposite. I think they were going after him for various reasons that may have had to do with the fact that he was the first African-American president, but it also had to do with the fact that they were just trying to feel their oats. I think the real dangers have come with some of the Republican statements that have stimulated more populism, dangerously so. I think Senator McConnell is particularly adept at manipulating the anger on the right and not doing anything to stand up to Trump. In Europe, again, I think the problem has been that it's been right-wing politicians that have manipulated the populism, Orban being the best example, but so is Nigel Farage in the UK. And various other places, while liberals have often sort of said, okay, these are, we don't know quite what to do about this. We're not gonna respond. And that's why I fear that the failure to adopt a coherent immigration policy on the part of liberals is particularly problematic. No, there's no one turning point that I think has stimulated more populism. I think a lot of it has to do with economic trends. And also demographic trends, as I've said. The growing diversity, the fact that the U.S. is becoming more of a majority country, and that the civil rights movement has achieved so much, and now there's a backlash against that.
And then here's someone who's noted that Euroscepticism is essentially a pushback against federalism, EU, et cetera. Do you see anti-federalist movements in the U.S.? E.g., is Alabama our Greece?
Well, it's interesting. Yes, one could say Alabama certainly proving to be a thorn in the side of experimental federalism, shall we say. No, I actually think, yes, I think Europe is having trouble with the American version of federalism. On the other hand, federalism, I think, is probably one of the great strengths of American democracy and one of the reasons why I remain optimistic today, because apart from Alabama and some other states, the laboratories for change and indeed the opportunities for the protection of the democratic institutions are being found at the state level. You've got this effort on the part of the some elements of the Republican Party to suppress the vote. Certainly the gerrymandering activities that have taken place have led to a backlash in a number of states that one would have actually thought might go the other way. For example, Wisconsin and Michigan have both adopted anti-gerrymandering initiatives. I think there's been some work here in Maine. I know that a number of people are experts on the Maine pushback. So federalism is something that I think gives us and the prospect of democratic renewal strength and opportunity rather than something that's dangerous. The reason the Europeans, at least the European leadership, doesn't like it is that they don't want to see, they don't want to be pushed into a corner where they where they're going to have to give up some of their sovereignty at the national level. But that's a different story from the United States.
Someone wants to know a little bit more about Hungary here. You see some hope for a voter correction in the U.S., but is, what about Hungary? Is that
Hungary is a very, very weak civil society and a very weak political opposition. That said, I think the thorn and or the potential thorn in the side of and the soft point of the Orbán regime is corruption. I mean, Orbán is indeed, and the regime itself has certainly been, in many ways, corrupt. A lot of the EU funds that come into the into Hungary and other countries as well are unregulated, and they are often find their ways into the hands of the various contractors who may be close to the regime. Now, there's been some public pushback against that. There was a lot of opposition to a number of measures that the regime, that the Orbán regime took to try to deal with a labor shortage, and it was a labor shortage that was a result of many people having left the country because they didn't like the regime. And so the Orbán government then instituted an overtime work requirement, which was very unpopular among, as you might imagine, labor unions and others, because it required people to work longer in order to make up for the people who'd left the country. And many of the people had left to the country because of the corruption of the regime. So that led to massive demonstrations in the streets in early 2019. But the weakness of the political parties in picking up this and using that as a way of more effectively challenging Orbán is probably is going to save him during this period.
And I have a whole fistful of questions here that I think are very closely related. People are worried about what happens if Trump is reelected, what happens if Trump is not reelected, and how close we are to a revolution in our country, either by true patriots or Trump base.
Yeah, these are the big questions. I'd actually almost welcome people's explanation of these questions rather than having me simply answer them, although I'm happy to try my hand at them, because I think they reflect some of your own thinking in ways that are not so much questions as they are statements. You know, I think the Trump reelection prospects right now, given the state of the economy and the confusion of the Democratic Party as we've seen it, is probably higher than I believe it will be as the election season moves forward, but I'm not here to prognosticate about that. In the event that Trump is reelected, you know, I think I see really few mitigating forces which are going to change his direction if the country remains as polarized as it is. And this is also the case in the event that he's defeated, because I think the polarization right now has put us in a place where my third point, which is the need for negotiation to save democracy, is really proving to be harder and harder, and that would be the case in whether or not Trump is reelected, because I think the country is deeply polarized. Now, all of this boils down to leadership. I mean, we need to find and then work with those who begin to articulate things the way, not necessarily the way I have, but some of the points that I've made, particularly about negotiation, because I believe that the polling data, such as we, who knows how much we can trust polling data, but the polling data does indicate that the country doesn't want to be as polarized. Yes, the Trump base, the 30%, obviously are never going to yield an inch, but those middle voters who are looking for some kind of moderate solution here would like to find a leader who is able to negotiate and to be pragmatic and show ways of trying to get things done. And I think the Democratic candidates have an opportunity to do this. So far, they've focused on the responding to the populism side, which I've been talking about, rather than demonstrating their pragmatic capacities. And somebody's going to have to start doing that, and start doing that effectively and in a way that reaches voters so that they attract that kind of person. So it's breaking down of the polarization is the biggest danger either way, whether Trump is elected or not.
And here's someone who thinks that maybe you're giving President Trump more credit than he deserves, saying that he's intentionally taking steps that lead to or create an illiberal democracy. Isn't he just an opportunist?
Yeah, I think he's probably the weakest when it comes to his capacity and his to govern, the weakest president we've ever had. That's a broad statement. I'm not a professional historian, but I think I think it gives him too much credit to call him an opportunist. I think he has found the sweet spot, and he just keeps trying to grow it, of anger and distrust, and he knows that if he fans that flame further and creates problems which he then can solve, he will continue to hold on to his base. He's proven that he really doesn't understand how to be a strategic planner in international affairs. He's proven that he doesn't know how to be a strategic planner in domestic affairs or how to work with the Congress or any of the other things. So, you know, he doesn't deserve credit for any of this. He is a product of the time. Orban is actually more of the opportunist and an effective one and a much better politician in that way than Trump is. But Trump has been sort of thrown up by the times. He is what the times are. And we need to move beyond and get out of these times and find a way to cut back on the polarization that he's causing. And not just he causes, because the reaction on the other side it only feeds into that in some ways.
Well, then let me conclude by asking a question related to money, because those are always the most important questions. What about Citizen United and money in politics? Is that a key factor?
Huge. Yeah, I could have devoted a whole section of my talk to that, and it's something that I've worked on in many ways. Yeah, I think we have, and this we really do differ in that respect from Europe, because we are captive in the United States to the First Amendment, which I have defended as a civil libertarian over many years. But insofar as you're going to equate speech and money, and protect the contributions of funding under the First Amendment and not recognize that it significantly downgrades the value of democracy, then you're just going to have all of this funding pouring in unlimited ways. I mean, it's good to see that the Democratic candidates are, some of them anyway, trying to run entirely on small contributions, but the engines not just money in politics in terms of campaigns, but the ways in which lobbying activities and all of the above are almost completely unregulated, really has caused, I think, a highly toxic environment for American democracy. And this is probably the single biggest electoral reform, if you will, that could be adopted by a Democratic president. I was pleased to see that the under Nancy Pelosi's leadership, the House of Representatives introduced H.R. 1, the very first bill that was introduced in this new Congress, is indeed a comprehensive electoral reform that would deal with a combination of voter suppression, gerrymandering, and financing of political campaigns. So it's very much on the agenda. I think I'm glad it was brought up because it's clearly a crucial issue here.
All right. Well, we're going to thank you very much then.
Thank you, George.
Really appreciate it.
Thanks.
John, before you get off the stage, we'd like to present you with the much coveted Midcoast Forum mug so that you can have your morning.
I was looking for it and I wondered where it was. Thank you very much. Thank you. Great. Thanks a lot.